so much for having me, and good evening, everyone. I was a very nostalgic child, blending fairy tales with horrible histories. I'd spend hours luxuriating in an imagined and rose-tinted view of a past I'd never experienced. I was a huge Enid Blyton fan, and I spent so much of my time wishing and demanding almost my parents would send me away from my 1990s like local primary to a boarding school in 1950s Cornwall so I could live out those fantasies. They refused, and so instead I spent every day going to my otherwise uniform-free state school in a little button-down shirt and pleated skirt. As I grew older, I cut some of these emotional ties to the past and developed a much more cynical relationship with history. I did a history degree and then another and another, turning into a much more steely academic that tried to avoid the kind of sentimentality I'd indulged in the past. And the reason for this is that academic historians have a pretty low opinion of nostalgia. They see it as the preserve, or rather, they tend to see it as the preserve of amateurs, reenactors, hobbyists, popularizers. They can be snobs sometimes. But really, the point of being an academic historian, after all, is to turn a much more critical lens at the past, a critical lens at history, and see it for what it is, warts and all. Nostalgia and that kind of vision of the past don't really meld very well. And also, nostalgia is supposed to be at odds with some other aspects of my personality or identity, I suppose. I see myself as politically progressive and personally an optimist. But despite all this kind of shift away from nostalgia, I do sometimes still allow myself a bit of the feeling now and again as a little treat. And sometimes this feeling of indulging in nostalgia is a slight embarrassment because even beyond the walls of the ivory tower, it doesn't just have to be academics, but nostalgia has something of a poor reputation. It is seen as a small C conservative emotion, and sometimes a big C conservative emotion. The sociologist Yaneth Gabriel called it the latest opiate of the people. And it's supposed to be something indulged in by antiquarians and sentimentalists, and it is still blamed for a range of perceived social and political sins. But for all of that bad rep, nostalgia used to be even worse. You don't have to travel that far back in time to find it listed as a cause of protracted illness or even death. Nostalgia was first coined as a term and used as a diagnosis in 1688 by a Swiss physician called Johannes Hofer. Derived from the Greek nostos, or homecoming, and algos, or pain, this mysterious disease was a kind of pathological homesickness, a yearning, place-based sickness. It caused lethargy, depression, and disturbed sleep, but it could also cause physical ailments like heart palpitations, open sores, and dementia. For many people, although not all, it could prove fatal. Sufferers would slowly starve themselves to death. It was particularly common, or supposed to be, among students, mercenary soldiers, and domestic servants, so anyone who was compelled to leave their home. It was first coined in 17th century Switzerland, and the Swiss were supposed to be uniquely vulnerable, partly because Switzerland was supposed to be so beautiful that anyone who left it would be so desperate to return. It continued, though, and spread far beyond the confines of not just Switzerland, but Europe. And during the American Civil War in the middle of the 19th century, it was the leading cause of non-combat death for soldiers. So even those who weren't didn't fight and die in battle would succumb to this kind of pathological homesickness. And the last known victim of nostalgia was a foot soldier fighting on the Western Front in 1917. So that was his cause of death listed on his death certificate. In the 20th century, nostalgia loosened its grip on the medical mind, parted ways with homesickness, and morphed first into a psychological disorder and then into the relatively benign emotion, although still troubled one, we know and love today. Early psychoanalysts, in the 1930s and 40s had a pretty low opinion of the feeling and very little patience for the nostalgics they encountered on their therapist couches. They thought nostalgics were neurotic or unable or unwilling to face reality. And frankly, these psychoanalysts were pretty snobbish. They thought that the middle classes were less likely to be nostalgic than lower class or tradition bound people. They thought middle classes were forward looking, cosmopolitan, not backward looking or stultified. In the 1970s, these psychological and psychoanalytic views softened, and psychologists today have a very different vision of the emotion. They see it as a near universal and fundamentally positive feeling, a powerful psychological resource that provides people with a variety of benefits, both social, emotional, and psychological. They've done studies and they claim that it can boost self-esteem, increase people's feelings of meaning in life, foster a sense of social connectedness, encourage people to seek help and support for their problems, improve mental health, and attenuate things like loneliness, boredom, stress, or anxiety, something of a panacea. It can even be used and is used as an intervention designed to maintain and improve memory among older adults, particularly people with dementia. It can be used to enrich psychological health and ameliorate depression. But despite these efforts on behalf of psychologists to kind of, I suppose, rehabilitate nostalgia, the reputation of the emotion today, particularly as an influence on politics and society, is not so honeyed. It is blamed for the rise of several political populist movements and the kind of past that nostalgic are seen to evoke now is often criticized for being overly white, overly male. Things like imperial nostalgia, colonial nostalgia, these sorts of political touchstones are common and pervasive. Nostalgics are still often described as retrograde, conservative, and sentimental. They're blamed for the electoral success of people like Donald Trump, and lots of people blamed Brexit on nostalgia, on a kind of epidemic, I suppose, of the condition. And this is where I think there's something funny in the afterlives of, on the afterlife of nostalgia as a disease, as it was in the 17th, 18th, and 19th centuries, because I think in some ways it remains a kind of diagnosis, not so much a prompt to further investigate, but rather as a kind of almost dismissive explanation for what a critic might see as wayward or even irrational acts like voting for Brexit or Donald Trump. As the historian Robert Saunders put it, in reference to Brexit, the prevailing rhetoric marked out the Leave vote as, and I quote, a psychological disorder, a pathology to be diagnosed rather than an argument with which to engage. And this is strange, this kind of tendency to lump nostalgia in with the political right, with populism, because nostalgia is, of course, a feature of left-wing political life as well. Think of the NHS, a much-loved British institution and a bastion of left-wing political identity. I'm a historian, and by training, I'm a historian of medicine and healthcare, and my real kind of area of expertise is the history of the NHS. And there is a lot of nostalgia in and about the NHS. You can kind of see that best encapsulated in the pageantry around the Olympic Games opening ceremony in 2012, when women dressed up as 1950s nurses danced across the stage. And I think there's this real kind of attempt to capture an NHS of days gone by. But it also doesn't really work as an explanation for right-wing tendencies or populist political leanings. Because if you take present day psychology seriously, everyone is nostalgic pretty much all of the time. And it doesn't seem to track along political lines. And as I sort of mentioned, nostalgia is more than just benign. It can be actively therapeutic. So psychologists say that when people indulge in nostalgic reflections, the mind is peopled. The emotion can affirm symbolic ties with friends, lovers, family members. And in the moment of nostalgia, close others come to be momentarily part of one's present. It helps people feel more loved and protected, reduces anxiety. People who have nostalgic tendencies are also more likely to have secure attachment styles, and they're even supposed to have better social skills. And so perhaps, and this I think is really the undercurrent of my book, or rather the thing I wanted to explore when I started writing it, perhaps nostalgia needs a bit of rehabilitation, even in other non-psychological areas of life. Because as I've sort of talked about, nostalgia as a society as a whole, and especially academia, my kind of home, tends still to see emotions as irritants, as contaminants. And while there is, I think, more and more cultural pressure to talk about our feelings, acknowledge trauma and distress publicly, and seek help and support when unhappy, anxious, or depressed, at the same time, some emotional responses are still seen as more appropriate or adult than others. I write a bit about homesickness in the book as well, and I think that's something that's, you know, really is infantilized. Political and professional decisions that are seen to be driven by feelings are still taken less seriously than those deemed motivated by reason, rationality, or research. And of course, as a historian, I'm very keen on research. But as a historian of emotions, I'm also keen on feelings. I'm interested in their variety, curious about their range, and I think I take very seriously their power. And nostalgia, I think, or maybe I'm suggesting, could do with something of a makeover. Can it be rescued from its associations with the sick, the stupid, and the sentimental? And the way I've kind of opted to think about and write about nostalgia is to see it not just as a kind of malign presence in modern society, but a source of both pain and pleasure, something that explains so much about modern life. It is one way that we communicate a desire for the past, like for me, a dissatisfaction about the present, and perhaps paradoxically even our vision for the future. And I suppose I wrote my book to think about whether nostalgia has the capacity to be progressive as well as conservative, not just stultifying, but maybe creative too. And instead of isolating, whether politically or personally, can we see it instead as a profoundly social emotion, one that can draw us together, not just push us apart? I hope you've enjoyed this and give a little taster, and you'll have to read the book, I suppose, to find out if I've been successful. Thank you.